Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate Pick Your Own Farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Nature is in trouble, therefore we are in trouble. That's the conclusion of a United Nations report released last month describing what it will mean for all life on Earth if 1 million species go extinct. The UN says the most dire predictions could be held off if we make what it calls transformative change and do it soon. Today in The Exchange, we take this enormous report and bring it down to New Hampshire's level. What does it mean for all living things in our state, including humans? Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Doug Bechtel, president of New Hampshire Audubon. Doug, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
Also with us, Mike Marchand, non-game and endangered wildlife program supervisor at New Hampshire Fish and Game. And Mike, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Also with us, Jennifer Seavey, John M. Kingsbury, executive director at the Shoals Marine Laboratory. Jennifer, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
And also with us, David Patrick, director of conservation programs at the Nature Conservancy in New Hampshire. And David, welcome back. Thank you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, this report is so huge. It's almost overwhelming. David, starting with you, how do you bring it down to your own level working locally here in the Granite State?
Well, I think when you read the report, one thing that's clear is that the threats to biodiversity globally are touching down right here in New Hampshire. So when we look at the list, you know, beginning with habitat alterations, that's the loss, the fragmentation, and the degradation of our native habitats. That's here, it's present, it's clearly documented in our Wildlife Action Plan that documents the principal threats to biodiversity here in the state. And we have real issues there. Similarly, when we think about climate change as a driver, we're seeing sea level rise, we're seeing, you know, increase in our extreme events, particularly rainfall. Pollution and toxification, you know, on the news on a daily basis, we look at the threats to our waterways, to our lands. And similarly with invasive species, you know, things like emerald ash borer, they're a real threat to our forest economy and the health of our forest ecosystems. And one other thing I'd also add is that when we look at those threats to nature, we're seeing the consequences for people as well. And we see that inextricable link between the well-being of our natural systems and the well-being of our human systems as well. So with that list I just provided, we can see how all of those things are coming down and affecting the people of the Granite State. You know, just as one example, I think we used to take for granted that we had clean, abundant drinking water. Well, nobody does that anymore. Yeah, we have clear evidence that that's not the case, and we have some real things we need to deal with.
So all these stories that we've covered here in The Exchange for years, you know, the white-nosed bat, the plight of the moose, the emerald ash borer, you're making the connection between those individual stories and this big global report, David.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, the global report in some ways it comes as no surprise because we've been seeing those trends as you've articulated here in the Granite State. And I think one other thing that's really important to recognize is that we as the people of New Hampshire play a role in those global trends as well. So, you know, when you look at, we go to the grocery store, we, you know, the energy we use, the products we buy, most of those things aren't produced here in New Hampshire. In fact, many of them aren't produced in the United States at all. So when you look at the drivers of loss of rainforest in the Amazon, in Amazon, some of those things are coming because of the decisions we make here in the Granite State. And so we have the ability and the opportunity to influence these global patterns through the decisions we make on a daily basis.
Doug, what does this mean to you working at New Hampshire Audubon? Again, it's huge, it's global, it's overwhelming. How do you translate this to your work here in New Hampshire?
Well, I would just echo a lot of what David said. I think the one thing that I focus on a lot is that everything that we're working on here in New Hampshire is happening everywhere in the planet. And we have a responsibility in New Hampshire to set an example for our partners, our citizens, our visitors. And everything that we do as environmental professionals also has a direct tie to the economy. One of the things that you've seen in the conservation movement is this imperative that we must connect our work to people. All our organizations were inspired by nature, by declines in nature, by celebrating nature. I think there's been a real recognition that we're doing this for the people of our planet, for the people of our state, and we can't do it alone. All the people represented on the show are partners working for a common cause.
One of the people close to the report, Doug, said, quote, "Most people are blissfully unaware of what biodiversity does for them." What do you think, Doug? How do most people view this term biodiversity and whether it matters to them?
Well, I think, let me speak for myself. One of the things that I did preparing for speaking with high school students recently at a climate conference for high school students here in Concord, when you leave your house every morning, you are interacting with biodiversity between the time you leave your door and when you get into your car. For example, this morning, I saw or heard 6 different species of birds in about 10 seconds. That's something we take for granted no matter where we live, but there's wild biodiversity, there are wild animals that make an influence and have an impact on our lives every day. And I think making sure that that recognition is clear and how lucky we are to experience that is what attracts me to these issues and gives me hope for issues like this. I love birds, so for me it was a
recognition. With New Hampshire Audubon, that makes sense.
So just experiencing how lucky we are in New Hampshire to have somewhat clean and intact habitats gives me hope, and also I think gives us a chance to set an example for the rest of the world.
How about you, Jennifer, working on the coast? What does this report mean to you?
Well, as a director of a marine lab, field stations and marine labs around the world, and certainly here in New Hampshire, are really critical to science behind this report, internationally and locally. In this UN report, 400 experts were involved from 50 countries. Over 1,500 scientific documents were employed. Over 15,000 scientists commented on the report. To me, this is about the importance of science, and field stations are a great place for long-term monitoring, education of future scientists to do all of this type of work, and educating the public. And I want to really highlight the first one, which is long-term monitoring. The only way that we know about these long-term subtle changes in the environment is long-term data collection and analysis. And field stations are a really important place to do that because they have the support over time to maintain long-term data sets. And here at Shoals Marine Lab and other local stations, we have decades worth of data that shows the impact to subtle changes in the Gulf of Maine and how it's impacting marine species.
So the role of marine labs like yours has been very important in this, Jennifer. You talked also about your role of public education in addition to that important role of monitoring and getting all the data. What about the public understanding of the importance of biodiversity? Again, biodiversity sort of sounding like a insider term for environmentalists like you. Why does that matter to me?
So John Muir has this excellent quote that people bring into this conversation a lot. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. No species is alone. Biodiversity is a set of interconnected ecological systems that support human and natural well-being. And so there's deep connections to ecosystem services through biodiversity. The air we breathe, 50% of the air that we breathe, every other breath comes from the ocean. The other breath comes from the forest. These two systems are intricately intertwined to just let us breathe, never mind the rest of our ecosystem services from water filtering to shoreline protection. So talking about single species can get you sort of distracted by what's the meaning of that species. Thinking about them as a collective ecosystem and the services they provide really bring home the value to us.
We should definitely talk about that in a moment. The idea that species protection is often done, as you said, or talked about, as you said, Jennifer, species by species. We do a whole story on the white-nosed bat or a whole show on the plight of the moose. You're saying, let's look at the network that these species depend upon because, by the way, we all need clean water, clean air, clean land, and so forth. Mike, I want to bring you in, too. You worked on the state's 10-year wildlife plan. How do you see that state effort with this bigger context?
Yeah, so first off, I mean, that's this document that just came out is extremely impressive just because I can appreciate the amount of time and effort that goes into something like that, bringing together hundreds of scientists, all this scientific knowledge, and keeping that up to date. And so we went through that process with our wildlife action plan. And so similar to what others have said, it wasn't necessarily surprising to us. We've evaluated a number of those threats here in New Hampshire. We've come up with actions for a number of these species. And we've evaluated our success. In the first 10 years of our wildlife action plan, we actually initiated over 450 actions identified in our wildlife action plan. And we can only do that through strong partnerships in New Hampshire, including everybody here at the table as well as across the state. We have expertise in certain areas, and other people bring expertise in different areas. And again, I would echo clean water, clean air, and healthy wildlife populations is important to everyone here. And I would also add that there's a huge economic piece to this. There's been estimates that over $550 million are generated a year in New Hampshire towards a wildlife-based wildlife watching, hunting, and fishing, over half of that based on wildlife watching alone. So there's a huge economic incentive to maintaining these diversity in New Hampshire and healthy wildlife populations.
Well, and if the lakes get gunky and ugly, those property values are going to go through the floor. So there's that as well, and all the other effects. You mentioned actions taken to help wildlife under this Wildlife Action Plan from Fish and Game. Give us a couple examples, if you could, please, Mike, of the actions.
Well, our very first action after the first Wildlife Action Plan, our priority action was actually revising our threatened and endangered wildlife list. We had updated all our science based on bringing experts in. We got information from the public. We had stakeholder meetings bringing that information in. And we needed to update our list, which is a way of us prioritizing what work actually happens on the ground, what species-specific actions. And one example is bald eagle is a huge success story. And it was state threatened as a result at our prior wildlife action plan and our state threatened endangered species list. But due to the monitoring we do and our partnerships with New Hampshire Audubon, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and others, we felt very strongly that the species had recovered and is continuing to recover and warranted being delisted for our state threatened and endangered wildlife list.
So I'd like to ask about these lists, because this gets to something that some of you raised earlier, the idea of we focus on species by species by species, and the lists are helpful because they let you know where things stand. But I wonder what you think, David. For example, you know, on our state's list of endangered species, there are a lot of mussels, a lot of birds. You might think, okay, that's too bad about that mussel, too bad about that bird. It was pretty, but I don't feel that loss. My immediate survival doesn't feel at risk. So just help us make that connection a little bit more.
Yeah, so this challenge of sort of how do we articulate the value of these individual species and the trends and the declines in these species is a really important question. So I think we can look at them and their inherent value. So, you know, when we take
standing on their own,
yeah,
the muscle on its own.
And so when we take these things out of the system, when we see declines in these things, there's often unforeseen implications of that. So we see degradation of the entire system as a result, and sort of all of these players play a role. And often we don't know what that role is until they're lost. But I think it's as important and probably more relevant to most people to recognize that when we see these trends in individual species, we're talking about much larger issues. And really, we need to be tackling those much larger issues. So you may say, well, I don't worry too much about freshwater mussels, but I think most of us worry about, you know, having really poor water quality, or we worry about, you know, dams and culverts that block our waterways that mean that we have more catastrophic flooding that occurs. So depending on sort of the focus of an organization or of an individual, sometimes that single species focus is appropriate, but often we're talking about these more general issues. And so we can think about these organisms as sort of canaries in the coal mine, yeah? So if you see a decline in a species, that's generally indicative that there's a much larger issue that you should be worried about. And I think it also, you know, as we think about what we can do in response to these trends, for most people, you know, listening to this show today, you know, they're not going to be going out and focusing on freshwater mussels or rare bumblebees. But there are things we can do in our daily lives that make a real difference. You know, the decisions we make, how we manage our gardens, whether or not we take advantage of some of the incentives to weatherize our homes, to reduce our energy use, so that we're using less, you know, producing less fossil fuels. You know, when we next purchase a vehicle, getting a vehicle that's a bit more fuel efficient, getting involved in our communities and making sure that our communities are growing in a way that's sustainable, that conserves those resources that we rely on. New Hampshire's a wonderful state. We have this character of volunteer leadership driving our communities. There's so many ways for us to be engaged. And thinking about what we consume and what we use. When you're in the grocery store, take those reusable bags with you. You know, look at the packaging. Look at where things are coming from. There are, you know, the beauty of our daily lives is there are so many ways in which we can have a positive impact on the world around us. And I hope, you know, I hope that that provides hope, because it's very, you know, it's very tractable, and there are practical things we can do.
Well, think about that next time I stomp out to the composter in 3 feet of snow saying, why am I doing this? Go ahead, Jennifer, and then Doug.
Sure. I just wanted to circle back to the spectrum of what is conserving a single species versus an entire ecosystem. It does rely on a deep understanding, scientific understanding of those species. And there are certain species that are deeply connected to entire ecosystem function. For example, oysters. So oysters are what scientists call a keystone species or an ecosystem engineer. And they create, through their physical structure, a habitat that then supports hundreds of other species. So the loss of that single species can have a cascading effect.
Because they clean the water? They filter it?
Because they physically create the habitat for other species to hide in, all the nooks and crannies of an oyster reef. And then you just picked out an ecosystem service that they also provide, this physical structure, but also water quality filtering. All of those reasons make this a very particularly important species. And science has uncovered a number of species that you could point to that are very important, particularly because they are the keystone to the arch of the ecosystem. You pull them out and you lose a lot of species.
And let me put you all on the spot a little bit, that have environmental groups, I'll start with you, Jennifer, but Doug, I can see you want to jump in too. Have you focused too much on the individual species and not enough on educating the public that if you lose this one, you're also going to lose this one, and this one. And by the way, your water's going to be poisoned. Or by the way, your air won't be as clean. Or by the way, you're going to start to get icky scum on your pond. I mean, have you focused too much on save this mussel, save this bat?
So many of us enter into our passion for conservation through a single species or an experience of love of birds, perhaps, or love of whales or something like that. And that's the doorway to understanding the ecosystem services that they provide. And I use that word very broadly to be value for humans and value to the entire natural ecosystem as well. And so I do think that we are getting better and better. I think more people understand the term ecosystem services more broadly. And I think all of us sitting here are doing a lot of work to continue and enhance and broaden that education. I think it is really valuable and important that we can use sometimes these very charismatic species to open the door, but that we quickly pivot to understanding the whole value.
Go ahead, Doug, and then Mike. Yeah.
I think what we're talking about here is that everything is connected, and I love that image of connection. And there's a very useful metaphor to get back to the biodiversity issue, and that is think of an airplane. Everything has to work well on an airplane for the system to be safe. You can start losing rivets from your wing and maybe not notice that the plane is in trouble. When is that last rivet going to cause a real problem? What is the piece of that airplane that, if you lose it, will cause that plane to go down? And that's a metaphor that's been used for many years, but I think now the airplane is flying into a storm, and climate change, I think, represents a hurricane for that plane. So when we think of how everything is connected and how everything is essential, that's a useful metaphor that we've been using for a long time.
Well, coming up, a UNH environmental historian looks at how people digest alarming studies like these and how they might react. Plus, your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More on the future of biodiversity here in New Hampshire and what it means for all of us. In just a moment, stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with New Hampshire conservation and environmental leaders about an alarming recent UN report that predicts dramatic species decline due to the damage being done to the planet's environmental safety net that sustains all life. We're taking this giant report and bringing it down to our state's level. And let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our panel includes Doug Bechtel, president of New Hampshire Audubon, David Patrick, director of conservation programs at the Nature Conservancy in New Hampshire, Jennifer Seavey, John M. Kingsbury, executive director at the Shoals Marine Laboratory, and Mike Marchand, non-game and endangered wildlife program supervisor at New Hampshire Fish and Game. And Mike, just before the break, you were also wanting to jump in on the point that everybody was making, where I asked, have conservation groups focused too much species by species, not educating the public that if one species collapses, another one's going to collapse, and another one's going to collapse, and all of a sudden, human health is in trouble?
Yeah, exactly. So I just want to touch on the ecosystem versus single species approach. And so as the state agency responsible for maintaining threatened and endangered species, we certainly do focus some energy on maintaining those species, and we have a responsibility for making sure those species are there for future generations to enjoy the way that we enjoy them now. Some people compare that to, you know, the healthcare system, though. So once you get to be an endangered species, you're in urgent care, and it becomes very difficult to recover those species. And so you can, with time and the right resources, those species can be recovered, like bald eagles. But we also take a more holistic approach in trying to prevent those species from ever getting to that point by taking habitat management approaches through land conservation, habitat management, alleviating threats, et cetera, so that we reduce those species that ever get to that point. So we have a combination of those efforts in our wildlife action plans, ones that are a broader scale and ones that are really species specific.
Well, that's interesting. And maybe a little bit later we can talk about some of the things that your average person can do, but these broader state and local efforts around habitat management, because that's an interesting piece of it. I want to bring another voice into our conversation, though, now. Joining us on the phone is Kirk Dorsey, professor and environmental historian at UNH. And Professor Dorsey, always good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Laura. It's nice to be here.
So this UN report is so dire. 1 million species extinct, a polluted, more dangerous, less comfortable planet for those of us who are left, humans and others. How do people even begin to digest this, Professor Dorsey, without, you know, sort of rolling over and shutting off the radio?
Well, I wonder how many people do roll over and just shut off the radio.
Yeah.
The million species figure is important for focusing it. And if you do a Google search, you'll find all that. That's the headline that got taken out repeatedly. And at one level, a million species, you almost throw up your hands and say, well, what could I possibly
right.
do? Even if I save one or two species, we're still close to a million. And so it's hard to adjust to these things and to accept this level of responsibility. I think that's the ultimate message of the report, is that we have a level of responsibility, but it's very hard to accept that level of responsibility. It's easier to just say, well, maybe they're wrong.
Yeah. Well, you're an environmental historian. What have you learned from the past, Professor Dorsey, about how people have digested previous dire reports?
Well, I think about, as soon as I saw this report, the first thing I thought of was Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, because in effect, it was a similar report about pesticides and about what we were doing to our planet. And it gained a lot of attention. I was just looking at my copy. I use it in my environmental history class, and I read that 1992 was named one of the 50 most important books of the century in the United States, if not in the world. And so on one hand, it made a sweeping impact. President Kennedy spoke about it and drew a lot of attention to it. And a lot of people know Silent Spring, and they know the story. And yet, one might ask, how much has really changed since then? The example I think of is President Kennedy calling attention to it, but then shortly after authorizing the U.S. military to use widespread pesticides in Vietnam to get rid of foliage so that they could fight the war. So even as on one hand he saw the merit of the message, he still couldn't bring himself to say, well, maybe we should think about this and what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. Some things are more important than the environment, and effectively is what he was saying. And so I think it's easy for people to say, wow, a million species, that's terrible. But, I still need to make sure that my lawn looks green, or I'm tired of these things growing up between the bricks on my sidewalk, and I need to do something about that. And it's hard to make the connection from these big reports to actually changing the way you live.
So what's the value of them then, Professor Dorsey, if they don't really change the way your average person lives, putting all those chemicals on the lawn?
I think they do at some level cause people to think twice. You know, I was looking also at the criticism of this report, and one of the fascinating things was the critics saying, oh, these guys are just as discredited as Paul Ehrlich, you know, the guy in 1968 who said the population bomb that was going to end up basically doing the same thing, destroying biodiversity on the planet. And these warnings about biodiversity go back for decades. I mean, right after World War II, there were population biologists and scientists saying, you know, we're overpopulating the planet and it can't support us for long. So I think these things do take effect. I mean, if you look at the way in which we have population in most of the modern industrialized societies, you know, they're talking about population crises where we're not having enough kids to sustain our populations in the way we want. So people start making almost subtle, maybe even subconscious changes to the way they live. And so I think these reports are necessary for just trying to bring some attention to it. And you hope the change says, you know, at some point it becomes, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back, and people say, okay, now we have to make a change. So the reports have to be written. If you don't write them, people say, oh, everything's fine. And this way, at least a few people start shifting their positions.
A story in the Christian Science Monitor that quoted you, Professor Dorsey, and how people feel about these giant, dire reports also had another professor saying that these reports, like the UN's, can serve as either, quote, rocks or light bulbs. You probably saw that quote, the rock is your ammunition, the facts, the research. But this gentleman said that doesn't change minds. The light bulb is different. It's the aha moment that makes people care and take action. How do you see this report, Professor Dorsey? Is it a rock or is it a light bulb?
Right now, it looks more like a rock, but I also think that, you know, as a historian, we often know that what we think at the moment of that a document comes out or something happens is not always how it will be perceived, that people over time may internalize this. And your distinguished panel of guests are the people who are responsible ultimately for making sure that the people on the ground see this report in a digestible fashion and see, okay, well, I can actually do something about this. And this is dire. It's gotten to a point where we can't just ignore it and say, well, we'll be fine. The planet's still pretty green. We're going to be okay. And I think the way in which the light bulb has to happen is for people to say, so we've got the science, and we need some sort of sentimental attachment. We need some sort of reason to say it's not just about science. There's a species. You know, the way of climate change, people are trying to make the polar bear the symbol. And I think that comes back to your earlier discussion about single species conservation. You know, it's easier to sell somebody on a particularly charismatic piece of megafauna, whether it's a whale or a polar bear or something like that, and you hope for ecosystem benefits along the way. Then there also has to be the economic piece. And I think that's why this report is really emphasizing, for instance, pollinators of crops. You know, even if you don't particularly care about insects, you do like to have all the crops that are pollinated by insects. And so that has to, I think that message is the one that will change this into a light bulb moment, if anything will.
Well, I wanted to ask you that. Professor Dorsey, how important is it that economic interests are discussed as part of this? And I'm talking about not just businesses and corporations, but also just your average person who says, you know, okay, I care, but I still want to live in a comfortable place and eat reasonably good food. So, yeah, I'm glad that you're talking about this. Give us a little more there.
I think the economic piece has to be all of it. The first book I wrote was on the Migratory Bird Treaty Act from a century ago, and it became obvious that the environmentalists or conservationists at the time could talk about how wonderful bird song was, how beautiful birds were, but until they put it into a position of birds eat insects that eat crops. And so this is about protecting the food sources of the nation, and particularly the food sources of the nation during World War I, they just couldn't push through legislation to protect migratory birds. But once it had an economic angle to go with the sentimental angle of why we appreciate birds, that really helped put it over the top. And I think we could look at whaling in the 20th century. You know, it took people to start seeing whales not just as floating blubber, but instead as sentient beings that were singing to one another and were better than people. And then that sentimental part came in. They said, okay, but it still took the matter of saying, well, we don't actually catch whales in the United States. We don't catch many whales in Australia or New Zealand. So it's not really a hardship for us to give up whaling. And so the reason why Japan and Norway are not susceptible to those arguments about sentiment and even science is that they have a strong economic position. So I think if you don't have some sort of economic argument, you're just not going to win the day. People are going to have a hard time saying, all right, I'm willing to give up this piece, particularly if they think that other people aren't giving up as well. If I'm the one sacrificing, but over in, say, China or India, they're not sacrificing, then what good was my sacrifice?
One last question for you, Professor Dorsey, please. How do you talk about this report with your students? What do you hear from the young people that you work with in terms of how this report makes them feel?
You know, it's funny. The report came out right at the end of the semester.
Right.
And I was actually teaching modern foreign policy, so it didn't. The students were more tied into all the disasters in the modern world in terms of diplomacy than they were this particular disaster. And I'm teaching environmental history next semester. But you know, I know from having assigned them Carson, they read Carson and they've heard of it, and many of them have already read it coming in or are familiar with it, and they still can't quite grasp why we're still talking about Rachel Carson. Wasn't this proved, you know, almost 60 years ago? Why do we still need to be having these discussions? So I think the reaction from the students is going to be, we've heard about global mass extinction for a long time. Why are we still talking about it? Why haven't we done anything about it? And then there will be the other students who say, because it's really hard to do something about it, and what sacrifices are you willing to make? You know, one of the things the report points out is that for a lot of people, the damage they do is so far removed from them that they don't see it. You know, think about something like the Gulf oil spill from about a decade ago. That was really an eye-opening moment for Americans about, you know, the damage of drilling for oil. But there have been oil spills all over the world in our consumption of oil, but we just didn't see them because they were so far away. They were rarely brought home to us. So I think that the one thing this report will hopefully, if people pay attention to it and don't just dismiss it as impossible or fake science or junk science, as some of the critics are saying, as they always do, that the damage we do to the environment is not just right around us, but it's really now international. And the resources that we consume from around the world are having an impact around the world that we can't even see anymore.
So your students are frustrated when they read Carson. They say, hey, we've known about this for a long time. Why are we still talking about this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's an element of amazement that the older generation hasn't solved this problem yet.
Well, Professor Dorsey, it's always really good to talk to you. Thank
you
very much.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Kirk Dorsey again, professor and environmental historian at UNH. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, Michael sent us an email. Can you have your guests reiterate again the case that this loss of biodiversity is different than previous extinctions initiated by nature alone? Because this report says this extinction is human-caused. Michael also says, I know our actions are globally interconnected, but aren't the most egregious problems occurring outside the United States? He says, if I'm right, should we have federal programs that incentivize conservation outside the U.S.? And what role, if any, could the free market play in conservation outside our country? Great points, Michael. And Doug, why don't you take that first part? Can you explain if this loss of biodiversity is different than previous extinctions?
Well, one of the things that I think is very important about this report is it continues to emphasize that these crises are accelerating at rates that we've never been able to document before. For example, the rate of extinctions right now is 10 to 100 times faster than it has been in the last 10 million years. So I think that's the story that we have to pay attention to. This is a story about the rate of challenge. And I know that crisis is no fun to talk about, but one other fact that gives me hope is that 4 million people in this country turn 18 this year. And so the age group that the professor was just talking about is the hope that we have. That's a great trend. And those young people will be voting soon, and to have them motivated by this is really important.
Well, and to Michael's second part, and I'll throw this to you, Dave. Again, what about, as Michael puts it, the most egregious problems occurring outside the United States? And there are a bunch of causes in the report that have nothing to do with New Hampshire. Bushmeat eating, for example, poaching, that's not really happening in the U.S.
So that's certainly true that, you know, that there are major drivers going on outside of the United States. But I think it's also important that we recognize the role that we play in those drivers. Obviously, bushmeat being one that you know, that's hard to draw a link there. But on average, you know, per capita, per person, we use 30 times the resources of people living in developing nations. So we, you know, it takes 30 people in a country like Botswana to make up for one person here in the United States and the impact that we have. And we use about twice what we have in European nations. So we play a disproportionate role in driving these global patterns because of the decisions we make, which also means we can have a disproportionate impact if we change the approaches that we take. And so I think it is really important to recognize that this is a global problem. It's a global system that we're working with here, and that gives us some great capacity to make changes as a nation that will have global impact. And I was really interested in the caller's question around market-based sort of approaches that we might take. And I think there are some really exciting avenues there. Some of it comes down to actually putting a price on the damage that we're causing, putting a price on carbon emissions. You know, somewhere in the system, we're paying for those things, yeah? We're paying for the costs of poor air quality, and we pay for it in our healthcare system. So if we can find ways to build that into our market, into our economic models, then we'll have strong economic incentives not to be doing these things. And I think that's really important. We've not done a good job of capturing those externalities in the way that we value our resources and our impacts.
And just remind folks what externalities are.
Well, I'm not an economist, and so I'll do my best, and then my colleagues can jump in and correct me here. But externalities are sort of the costs of the things beyond
that you don't pay with dollars and cents.
Yeah, exactly. And so for example, like we typically don't have a price on pollutants. We don't have a price on greenhouse gas emissions.
Rising cancer rates.
Exactly. But those costs are felt somewhere in the system. And so I think, as we get better data, as we better understand those, we can develop models that are more robust to that. And then I think finally, I just say that leading by example, is so powerful and so important for us. Instead of going to a developing nation and saying, you shouldn't be harvesting your bushmeat, we should be really demonstrating the best practices here in the United States, here in New Hampshire. Back to Doug's point, we should be an exemplar. We have some great opportunities here. And I think, the more that we do, the more we can be held up as a leader.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize what Dave just said is us as leaders, especially in partnerships, because species do not adhere to our boundaries. And I'm a seabird biologist, and I can speak for the birds that I study. Some of them, the Arctic tern, in 1 year can travel 60,000 miles. That is not just, it breeds here in the state of New Hampshire, but it is all over the world. And I can attest to the fact that in the Gulf of Maine, seabird biologists are working across state lines very closely together because we recognize that these birds are all part of a larger population. And we work across country lines with partners in Argentina. We are monitoring terns that come from Argentina. So it is very important to be a leader of partnerships in this work, especially when you think about oceans and birds, these big migratory species. They don't care what country or state they're in. Everyone needs to be working together, and the U.S. can be a great leader for that.
What do you think, Jennifer, quickly about Michael's point? What role, if any, could the free market play in conservation? A lot of people are starting to say, these problems are not going to be resolved unless you get economic interests on board.
Sure. So from the marine point of view, the blue economy, the ocean-based economy, is almost $300 billion in the U.S. That's a really powerful group that can be incentivized for ocean health. They're depending on ocean health for over 3 million employees.
So that's not just fishing, but that's me going to Hampton Beach next month. That's all the people that own the property on Hampton Beach. That's
a big motivation and incentive to keep that environment healthy for all of us.
All right. Well, coming up, we will start taking your calls, so stay on the line. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email like Michael did. Michael, thank you for that one. It's exchange@nhpr.org.
What does NHPR mean to me?
That's a good question.
I feel when I'm listening to these stories that I'm there, that it's very personal.
It's quality programming that brings so much to my life.
It educates me in a way that no other station does.
I would encourage people to think about the value that NHPR brings into their daily lives.
And if you appreciate NHPR, you should be supporting it.
Support the station that educates and inspires you every day at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, another look at New Hampshire's parole system. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Join us for that, live at 9. This hour, a recent UN report predicts 1 million species face extinction if the damage done to the planet's safety net continues. The clean water, land, and air that support all living things. We're looking at this from a New Hampshire perspective. And let's get you into our conversation. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Jennifer Seavey, David Patrick, Mike Marchand, Doug Bechtel, let's go right back to our listeners. And let's go next to Dan Elliott in Elliott, Maine. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura, and your guest. Thanks so much. This is such an important program. I guess what I want to say is that I've noticed the loss of species in my neighborhood. I used to raise bees. I stopped doing that because of the loss year after year of hives. And also, but not just pollinators. I noticed a decrease in songbirds. Bats that used to fly around no longer do. Even common insects that I used to think of as pains in the neck, I now kind of mourn not seeing them. Last fall was the first time in my life that I didn't have houseflies in my kitchen at the end of the summer, and I'd have to, where I would normally have to hang up fly paper. And so it strikes me that we're starting to see this deeply now, and my concern is that many people don't recognize this because they spend, not they, we all spend so much time on screens that we're not really cognizant of what's going on around us.
So we're too busy looking at our phones and not paying attention to the fact that you haven't seen a monarch butterfly in 3 months. I've noticed myself, thank you so much for the call, Dan. I've noticed myself, I'll throw this to you, Dave. Monarch butterflies, I used to see them all the time. And when I was a kid, I used to catch lightning bugs all the time. And last summer, I saw a couple out in the backyard and I said, look, everybody, lightning bugs. So I know we've been talking about species like fish and mussels and birds and mammals, but the insect decline is concerning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what the caller just articulated is something where many of us are seeing, you know, in our daily lives. And I think in some ways it speaks to the urgency of this issue, these declines in these common species that are occurring rapidly enough that we actually notice, which in many cases sort of hasn't happened in the past. And I think, you know, insect declines in particular are of incredible importance. There's some really, you know, compelling evidence now that some of those insect declines globally are really, you know, tremendous in scale. And you think about the role of insects, they're at the bottom of the food chain. So, you know, some of the birds that Doug and his team love so much are aerial insectivores, you know, our swifts and our swallows and our martins. We've seen dramatic declines in those as well. Pollinators and the role of our native pollinators as well as our honeybees. I mean, they're absolutely vital for our economy, and they just bring joy to our lives. I mean, if you haven't had the chance, sit in your garden on a sunny day and just see the diversity of different bees that show up on the flowers. It's not just honeybees, but we're seeing those declines in real time, and the consequences of those declines are absolutely alarming. And again, those declines are indicative of the changes we're having in the environment, our uses of insecticides, our declines in some of the natural habitat that provides for the needs of these species. So I hope that this is a wake-up call to all of us.
Well, and so very quickly, and I can see everybody wants to jump in very quickly, so someone listening says, oh my gosh, he's right, the pollinators, the role in feeding fish and birds and so forth. What can the average person do, listening right now, Dave, to boost their little insect population in their little corner of the world?
Absolutely. And that's the great thing, is there are really practical things we can do. So many of us have a garden. And even if you don't have a garden, you have a window box. Yeah. So planting some of our native species that we can easily get at some of our nurseries, those species that, you know, are great for the pollinators. You know, thinking about some of that kind of scrubby habitat on the edge of your property that typically you kind of clear away. You know, that's the habitat that these organisms are overwintering in, so that they're either under the ground, they're in vegetation. Thinking twice before you use that insecticide spray, or maybe 3 times or even 4 times, and thinking about whether or not you really need to do that. There is a lot that we can do in the actions we take on a daily basis.
Although the scrubby habitat is where the ticks hang out, so we have been told on other shows, you know, clear out that habitat. Ticks hate short grass, they love long grass.
This is true, and I think, you know, certainly there's a balance with all of these things, yeah. And so thinking about, you know, the areas where your family, your young children are using on a daily basis, certainly keeping the vegetation shorter there. the reality is ticks are part of the way of life here in New Hampshire. And I think for all of us, you know, especially this year, you know, we're seeing a lot of ticks this year.
They used to not be, though. That's the thing.
They did. And again, you know, what we're seeing here is the change in the distribution and the abundance of species in response to climate change. That's the ultimate driver of our problems with ticks.
Mike, go ahead, jump in.
Yeah, I was just going to add, in addition to Dan's comment, in addition to things you can do on your own property, there's only a select few biologists in the state to actually collect this data. So we really rely on the public to submit their own observations and share that information. So we have a New Hampshire Wildlife Sightings website where people can submit their records. There's an eBird site for submitting your bird records. And that information is actually used, the science and the knowledge is actually used to look at these long-term trends and to actually determine whether that was just a blip that happened in 1 year or this is actually a decline that we're detecting as a longer-term trend.
Oh, that's interesting. And that relates to an email we got from William in Epping who says, over 60-plus years in southern New Hampshire, I have observed dramatic decreases of everything from moths and lacewings once attracted to nighttime lighting to mayflies and stoneflies, which used to emerge from water bodies, to the numbers of bees and wasps encountered around the yard. William asks, have any studies of local insect populations been done? Can the guests address the importance of insect populations as forage for birds, fish, and other wildlife? And I think you addressed that, Dave. But Mike, you seem to be saying partly the public can help us get this data.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's gaining more and more attention, obviously, because of the pollinator and the link to the agricultural community. But there are now ways to report monarch butterflies. There's a way to report other species. And there's growing interest in documenting those, you know, those trends.
Okay. Go ahead, Jennifer.
I think both of these callers really highlight a great action that any of us can do, which is make observations. And that's what Mike is saying. And it can be for your own personal knowledge or contribute to a citizen science project like what Mike is describing here. And there are many scientists need observant citizens, and you will care more about something you know more about. And Shoals Marine Lab is the largest undergraduate-focused marine lab in the country. That is our mission, is to prepare scientists, but also to prepare the public in an education and understanding of the natural world, because only after you understand it and experience it, that I would underline that. Education is great and it's powerful. But having an experience of watching what's in your backyard, as Dave suggested, having an experience of doing citizen science, that is what will ignite passion for people.
Well, that raises Dan's point. And Dan, thank you for the call. He's concerned that people are so busy looking at their screens that they're not noticing how many monarchs are in their backyards.
Yeah, and there's excellent scientific literature that actually points to getting out into nature is the antidote for this world that we live in right now, this screen-obsessed moment that we're in. Getting out in nature statistically has been shown to make you a happier, more content person. There's a whole book called Blue Mind about why do people spend so much money to go to the ocean? It actually makes you feel better. Mentally, physically. Forest bathing is a big thing in Japan. It's becoming more popular here. It helps you mentally. It helps you spiritually. That is a path to understanding the system that makes you feel good. Now educate yourself and then engage in understanding it and helping with the science.
I'd like to ask you about this too, Doug, because you mentioned that the 4 million Americans who turn 18 this year is a sign of hope. Maybe yes, maybe no. Those 18-year-olds, a lot of them are probably staring at their screens and not noticing the wasps that are in the backyard.
That's right. And I think that's where
not just the 18-year-olds, by the way.
That's right.
Most people are guilty.
So that's the real challenge for us in the coming decades and centuries. It's really to make sure that people are connecting. And I think connecting is a major message for me today. And that is connecting, as Jennifer was saying, with the outside world, connecting with other people, with partners. I mean, we didn't get into this business because we like being depressed, and we didn't stay in this business because we don't have hope. So I think there are solutions, but it starts with that connection to nature, and all of our organizations focus on that because we recognize that intrinsic value of the experience, and that will lead to action. It'll change people's behavior. It'll change people's behaviors. It'll change the way people vote. And it's critical for all of us to not let politics define this issue. It's people have to define this issue so that politicians follow. And I think it goes all the way through the ecology of the science. We're talking about the economy, but also, you know, how we feel as a nation and a world.
So that's interesting. And I can see you want to jump in, Dave, but that's interesting, Doug. We can't let politics grab a hold of this issue. When you talk about environmental issues, they are politicized right now. So how do you take what this report says about the network of life? We're talking clean air, clean water, you know, toxins in our soil and so forth. How do you make that non-political? Because right now it's pretty political.
Well, I think that's that New Hampshire is a great example of this. These issues are very bipartisan. There's many, many examples in our distracted world where issues on the environment cross political boundaries. People care about safety and health and what's around them. And all these things, as I said earlier, are connected. We can win on this issue because these are things that we're talking about that are important to everyone's lives. And it's fairly easy to find common ground on issues like this. And again, there are many, many examples where these are winning issues in our divided system right now.
Go ahead, Dave.
So I'm you know, thinking so much about what Doug was just saying there. And I think that, you know, when we look at, you know, when we look at these issues and we look at sort of the fundamental consequences for people, it speaks to that common ground. You know, the idea that we need air to breathe, we need water to drink, we need food on the table. And how we tackle those issues, I think, you know, there's a diversity of different ways. And for different people, it's, you know, there's different messages that are going to resonate. So for some people, it's going to be the economic arguments. That might be the dominant driver. For people living in our increasingly urbanized populations, you know, they're not able to get out into the forest on a daily basis. And so, that you know, the motivation for them is going to be different. I also think it behooves us to think about how do we make sure that we bring nature to people. And so as we look at our urban populations, you know, making sure that there are green spaces, making sure that we have educational programs that reach out to some of our, you know, disadvantaged populations. You know, when we look at these issues, we see social justice touching down really clearly here. Some of the populations that are most impacted by our air quality issues, by water, you know, water quality issues, they aren't the populations living in the rural areas of New Hampshire. They're the populations in Manchester. So how do we bring this message to those people? How do we help them form those connections? It's going to be very different to other people in New Hampshire.
Let's take another call. This is Betsy in Bartlett. Hi, Betsy. You're on the air. Welcome.
For 30 years, we've been feeding birds at our house, and this year we're sort of undergoing our own silent spring. They just haven't come back, and I'm wondering if this is something that's endemic to Northern Carroll County, if it's statewide, if it's just my house.
Wow. Okay. Betsy, thank you very much. Anybody want to jump in on that? Jennifer?
I can start. I'm sure Doug has something to say about this as well, but this is where long-term monitoring is really important. There's so much variability year to year, season to season, over time, and we don't have a good, clear understanding until we have long-term data collection. And there are a lot of really valuable citizen science monitoring programs, especially for backyard bird monitoring. And so I would encourage this caller especially to get involved in a backyard bird count. The Lab of Ornithology, Scholes is affiliated with Cornell, and the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell has a great program so that this person can put into context what's happening this season.
That's interesting. This theme keeps coming up of people paying attention to what's going on and keeping track of it. Mike talked about that too. Go ahead, Doug, real quick.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that a lot of times we're seeing natural fluctuations. I didn't have any birds at my bird feeder this winter, but then I went birding last week up in Pittsburgh, and the abundance was incredible. So I think that a lot of times we're just seeing, again, fluctuations. And I wouldn't worry too much about the birds at your bird feeder. They're going to come back.
Okay, so pay attention this year, Betsy. Pay attention next year and the year after that. I would only add that I have been woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning for the last couple mornings by lots of birds. So maybe they're all at my house, Betsy. Got an email from Doug in Northwood who says, I'm a landscaper in New Hampshire and have a hard time mowing lawns that have wildflowers. Could not mowing help with insect populations? Maybe a tax break for homeowners to give an incentive? This gets to, Dave, sort of the little things that you can do, not mowing, planting more wildflowers. What do you think?
I think it's a very practical thing you can do. And I mean, anybody who drives by my home in Wilmot will see a very ugly lawn because we mow around those wildflowers. And when they produce seeds, we mow over them. And so you have this shifting mosaic. And I think it's really around changing our perspective. So, you know, those flowers are beautiful. If you spend 5 minutes sitting by them, you'll see those insects coming in. And so, you know, there's an educational piece of things here as well, a change in what we consider to be a nice-looking lawn. But one of those really practical steps that people can take, it's low cost. In fact, it saves you money, and it makes a difference.
Mike, what are some of the practical, on-the-ground things that you think people can do, maybe part of the Wildlife Action Plan, or maybe just part of what you do yourself?
Yeah, so I offer a little bit of hope here. So we have a Wildlife Action Plan, which we have the actions in place. We have 169 species of greatest conservation need. We have actions identified for all of them. We have great partners in the state. We have passionate people and citizens that live here that want to see wildlife, want to see healthy ecosystems. And so we have that all in place. You know, resources can be challenged. I hate to bring it there, but you know, one of the big success stories in history was the establishment of Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson, which provided funding for sports fish and game species. And so state wildlife grants were a huge important piece in the early 2000s. And that has, as Doug mentioned, had huge bipartisan support to continue for these biodiversity protection. But there's all types of things people can do locally, from the pollinator gardens to just helping a turtle across the road during nesting season to managing habitat, providing nesting habitat for turtles, all kinds of things. And all those are identified, or many of those are identified in the Wildlife Action Plan.
And the Wildlife Action Plan, by the way, is on our website. And also there's a picture of it on Instagram because it's huge, pretty impressive. I want to end with you, Doug. Can you leave us with a little bit of hope that this isn't all just the end of the world as we know it?
Go outside. Connect to nature. It really will inspire you to act. I went fishing with my dad and birding with my mom, and it really made a huge impact on my career and my life, and it's going to influence how I raise my kids.
All right. All of you, this has been great. Thank you very much for coming in. We'll have you back and talk about this again, for sure. Jennifer, it was good to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
Jennifer Seavey, John M. Kingsbury, Executive Director at the Shoals Marine Laboratory. Mike Marchand, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
That's Mike Marchand, Non-Game and Endangered Wildlife Program Supervisor at New Hampshire Fish and Game. Doug, thank you for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Doug Bechtel, President of New Hampshire Audubon. And David Patrick, thank you again for your time.
Thanks for the opportunity.
David Patrick, Director of Conservation Programs at the Nature Conservancy here in New Hampshire. Our conversation always continues online on Facebook. And also check out our Instagram for some photos, pictures, information about what happens behind the scenes here on The Exchange. Again, it's NHPR Exchange. You've been listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.